Good morning. This is Claudia Shambaugh welcoming you to the March 29th edition of Ask a Leader. We'll hear Chris Bragg and Don Hart. They're affiliated with the AIDS Services Foundation of Orange County, and they'll talk about the 30th anniversary AIDS Walk, the progress made, and the progress pending in this public health arena. We'll be right back after, you know, the shortest station break ever. Thanks for staying with us, everybody. That was what's my new jingle till I can find that township. Peace, Africano, Americano, that I've loved using for years. Well, welcome back to the show. My guests for this poll hour are Chris Bragg and Don Hart in advance of the upcoming 30th annual, count them 30, the AIDS Walk on May 14th, right nearby at Mason Regional Park. First is Chris Bragg, who is the Director of Development at AIDS Services Foundation of Orange County. We may refer to it as ASF at a later point in the show. Chris primarily works with individual donors and corporate partners to establish financial sustainability for AIDS Services Foundation of Orange County. His affiliation with ASF stems from his firsthand experience of the impact of HIV on a family member. So most recently, Bragg served as ASF's Director of Major Gifts, and before that, he was Director of Individual Giving and Events. He graduated from California State University, Chico, with a bachelor's degree in organizational community, and currently resides right here in Irvine. Don Hart is a 56-year-old long-term survivor of AIDS. Born and raised in Detroit, Michigan, Don moved to Los Angeles as a 20-year-old. He became infected with HIV in late 1981 before the virus had a name, before symptoms were identified as a virus. He'll talk about his survival strategy working around that stigma today. Over the next 30 years, Donald was as a software and systems architect, acquired 12 U.S. patents. Early in his career, he was confounded by full-blown AIDS dementia, which finally was improved when he began taking life-saving medications. In 2013, Donald decided to end his career due to neurocognitive decline caused by the virus and the extremely toxic medicine that he'd been taking over two decades. This decline coincided with the effects of post-traumatic stress, survival guilt, and exhaustion. Now successfully treating these mental disorders along with HIV, Donald has signed on toward helping those infected and affected and to fight the stigma. He matriculated at Michigan State University, UCLA, the University of Colorado, and then on to Cal State University, Los Angeles, where he completed his Bachelor's of Science degree in computer science. His studies began in 77 and 1991. You can see what he's been doing simultaneously, amazingly. Both Chris Bragg and Don Hart join me in studio today. Welcome, gentlemen, to Ask a Leader.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, Claudia.
That was Chris and Don, respectively. So let's start at the very top general idea. Why does Orange County need to be concerned about AIDS and HIV issues?
You know, and I'm glad you asked that because some variation of the question why is the most common question I hear. You know, whether it be why is ASF relevant because HIV and AIDS isn't in Orange County, or if someone has HIV, they just take a pill and everything's okay. The reality is there are 7,000 people living with HIV just right here in Orange County, and that number increased by 5 new infections last week, and it will increase by 5 more new infections this week. So despite the fact, what I would consider overly optimistic, if not slightly misleading headlines, there is no cure, and HIV and AIDS remains very much a real issue in our community today.
Don, you're living alongside it. Maybe you would like to add, too, because you're working very actively on the personal and the sort of organizational fronts. What can you add to that? Why Orange County?
Why Orange County?
Yes.
Because AIDS is everywhere. Orange County, because it's our community. So that's why it's very important.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So I think a lot of our listeners would be surprised to know who's at greater risk of contracting AIDS. Could you break down the demographics for us?
Well, I could, and that's a great question, and I hear that a lot. And my response is always, let's not look at the demographics, because the demographics is a way of suggesting to people that perhaps I, because I'm not of that demographic, that I will not be at risk. That is not true. The real thing to be aware of and educating people on is how the virus is transmitted. That's the key thing. There is no demographic based on that. I also feel it's very important for the listeners to know that the highest risk that I see, okay, is alcohol. Alcohol I see in the youth. I see even on campus here, even though our drinking age is 21, I've seen it common for students to carry around a flask with alcohol. My point here is that alcohol inhibits your judgment to make good decisions should you be engaging in sexual activity. So I would really like that people focus on how the virus is transmitted and make sure that they don't engage in activities where that could happen. And to make the best decision is to be in the right state of mind at all times. So that, to me, is the, certainly in college campuses, that's the big risk, is having an inhibited mind so that you engage in unprotected sex. That's the problem.
Wow. And I've heard that also mentioned, the alcohol is the contributor to at least 98% of sexual assault. So I guess there's a all points bulletin here for alcohol, folks, is a confounding element in socializing. So you bring that to AIDS. I know what you're saying about the essential knowledge of how AIDS is transmitted. When Chris and I were preparing about this, we were talking about, I think still will surprise people about where there is an at-risk population, both the youngest and sort of the elder population. Do you want to break that down for us, Chris?
But sure.
The point was well taken, though, what Don's talking about.
Yeah, right. I had talked to Chris, and he's got good points about how it applies to the youth of this campus, so I'll let Chris take over here.
Yeah, and to Don's point, you know, it's not a disease that does discriminate. Anyone can contract this virus. But if you look at a few of the groups or populations that might be disproportionately affected, the youth is one of them. You know, 29 and younger, we're seeing more new infections in that group than we were in other age groups. Another age group that's seeing an increase in infections would be our senior citizens as well. If you were to look at some of the other populations that are disproportionately affected, here in Orange County, the Latino community
Go ahead. Go ahead. No, but while we're with the seniors, though, why is it that there's a lot of reasons why seniors, and I want to make this a public service directed toward our appreciation of the seniors and any seniors that are listening, is why seniors are so at risk.
There's a number of different theories really out there. It could be that a lot of the seniors now were kind of past. They were already past their youth, if you will, during the epidemic in the 80s and 90s. And so maybe didn't acquire all of the education around prevention.
Which means they weren't protecting themselves.
Which means they weren't protecting
That's
themselves.
That's correct.
And, okay. And may find themselves in a life situation now where they just don't have that education and they're still not protecting themselves, which is why we're seeing a little bit of a spike in that community.
And a mindset like, it's sort of like a reverse invincibility. I made it this far. There couldn't be any kind of AIDS in my demographic, so I should be spared that. But there is.
Right. And I think
their guard's way down.
Unprotected sex is the risk.
Right.
It doesn't matter the age. It's transmitted through the blood.
And I think it speaks to Don's point earlier about, if you don't believe you're part of the group that may be impacted, well, then you're not likely to protect yourself. And I think that's what we're seeing in that particular population.
Okay. I don't know if there's alcohol being served. That could be a yes, Don?
No, but I do know that in senior centers,
yes.
Senior living places,
yes. Yes.
And I have relatives that sexual activity is quite rampant. and good for them. But again, safety. They're not being educated. They should be educated by the staff of these places. There's just a lot of education that needs to take place until there is a cure.
And I guess I'm going to break one more medical thing down there, too, is that with the onset of dementia, if the hippocampus is affected, that's a kind of social regulator. And if there's no regulator, that could also be a factor in sort of more unprotected and faster sex.
Right. Yes.
From what I've read and experienced.
Yes, that's true. I will say this about the dementia, though.
Yes.
Is that you won't see much dementia anymore. Like you did in the old days. The reason is that we're saving the lives, and dementia actually comes at the end of your life.
Right, right. That's what I was thinking of, that on the Alzheimer's type, not the AIDS.
Well, and they're quite related.
Okay.
Oh, extremely related.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely. Symptoms, yeah, they're identical.
And we were going to have you open that up a whole lot more when we turn the mic all the way over to Don to talk about his experience.
We have plenty
of opportunity about that. So Don, this is the time when I want to do that. Your life's remarkable trajectory spanning the psychological and the mental health zones. It's one that demonstrates a good many things. Along the way, it lays out what advances have been made and what remains to be done. I want to hand the mic over to you now to tell us your story from the start when you realized you had symptoms.
Yes.
What you were coming to terms with, how you had to work with what was to go public and what wasn't, and most won't be going public for many decades, and how you decided what was going to be your medical regimen, all of those steps along the way from the very beginning. Don Hart, take it away.
Oh, that's a pleasure. Thank you. So everything really began. I was a student at UCLA in the early 80s, and I met somebody and fell in love and started developing symptoms of an unknown virus. And when I went to the UCLA clinic, they sent me to West Hollywood Clinic and eventually just identified my symptoms as an unknown gay plague at that time. So in the background and talking with a couple of friends, we decided that we needed to change how we had sex, and so we were forced into safe sex practices very early because we didn't even know how the disease was transmitted. It may have been transmitted by kissing, even that, we didn't know. Maybe even hugging, we didn't know. All medical personnel were wearing rubber gloves. People were being served food at their door. And so the medical personnel didn't feel safe to approach people. So all of that stigma around the disease, for me personally, prevented me from having anything to do with that disease. I didn't want to be labeled. I had a feeling that if anybody found out of my status, that I would be put in a database. I would be restricted of my potential of the things that I wanted to accomplish in my life. I was, you know, after all, a sophomore student. So my strategy for several years, and when the virus was a couple of years later identified, and then first AIDS was discovered, and then after AIDS was discovered, the HIV virus that caused the AIDS was discovered, and then we were able to start medications. During all of this time, and this was a five-year period before even medicines of any kind were available, you just had people dying and.
Well, Don, let me just ask, while you're in this portion of your narrative here, what became of the person with whom you fell in love when you were also realizing you had symptoms?
That's a really good question. What became of him is he, and I found this out afterwards because I had split up with him. The end story is that he died in 1995. And they just had a film put out last year to celebrate his 20-year anniversary of his death. So he was well celebrated in New York. But he died right before the medicines, the life-changing, life-saving medicines that came out in 1996.
So one thing you're talking about sounds like the stigma was also amidst the gay community. It wasn't gay community and beyond, but within the gay community, that stigma was harbored.
And I suspect, and I'll be honest with you,
yes,
part of my survival strategy was I was thrown right back into the closet. So there was no gay life that I was aware of. I was a student living a closeted life. And I had in my mind, I thought because of all of the misinformation that was being put out about AIDS and the pictures you saw in the newspaper, I thought always that if I was part of that and they knew I was gay, they would make a connection that I was I might have AIDS, just because that's the way people thought.
A syllogism of sorts.
So it forced a lot of people right back into the closet during those times because they thought there was an association. Initially, the gay people, if you were gay and you slept with another man, you really thought that you could have AIDS. We just didn't know.
All right.
And so that was a scare. So we were able to develop our personal strategies. And so my strategy was avoid anything gay, anything HIV, for years and years and years. Okay, and I was very successful in maintaining a very healthy lifestyle because I knew eventually it would hit me because I studied the virus and how it proceeds. But I also knew I had a good 14-year period maybe. So I was living healthy and going about my normal life. What happened was in
yes.
the mid-90s is mm-hmm. after I, you know, like Claudia mentioned, is that eventually, unknowingly, My mind just went away, and I developed a really, really serious dementia where I was not able to walk or talk. I had to be fed. But at the same exact time, they came out with a cocktail of medicine that was different than the previous generation of medicine. And it was the medicine that actually was saving lives.
Well, when you were experiencing that dementia,
yeah,
were your care providers aware of this, or was there any kind of not a black label warning, but there some kind of heads up to you, or when the beginnings of the symptoms that you were getting some kind of explanations, or this was another sort of incoming. Sort of confounding unknown for you to juggle?
It was completely unknown. And at this time, because I had been so successful at thinking that the AIDS wasn't going to take over me, I was going around. I was actually on a business trip, and all of a sudden I couldn't start my car, and I thought the ignition was broke. I called the AAA, and I told them the car wouldn't start. And I found out that actually you had to press the clutch, and I had been pressing the clutch for 2 weeks, and then all of a sudden one day I couldn't figure out that you have to press the clutch. Little things, but I just kind of brushed them off. I'm stressed right now because I never associated AIDS with the brain. I just didn't. I didn't know that there was this dementia that occurred at the end of the life of an AIDS patient. Okay. I only saw AIDS as purple sores and people in a hospital bed and skeletal looking and ready to die. And since I didn't see that in the mirror, I just never thought that when my mind was starting to go away that it was AIDS associated. So I did the right thing. I noticed something was wrong. I thought there was something misconnected between my brain and my physical appendages. And so I went to a neurologist, and then I had tests done. I said, I have some problem with my brain. And eventually, and they couldn't find anything. And eventually, I just was, I guess, found somewhere and it put in the hospital. And then I was in the hospital bed on an IV when they did a test, and they thought, well, maybe we should do an HIV test, and they did. And then when they found out from the numbers, revealed, you know, how long the virus was incubating in my system for so many years. So a lesson learned there for new generations.
Yes.
We now have good medication, so there's no need necessarily to wait so long, and it can be quite damaging. As it turned out, I probably did a whole lot of damage to my brain and my body by letting the virus build for so many years, and I was not attacking it. People now, this isn't the case anymore. There's not a reason for that.
And we'll talk about that more in some detail. For those of you who've just joined us, my guests are Chris Bragg and Don Hart. Don Hart, whom you've been hearing for the last stretch. This is in advance of the upcoming May 14 AIDS Walk. We're giving everybody a lot of lead time, so you can sign up and join in on that. That event, it's at Mason Regional Park. Don Hart is right now in the middle of telling his story about how he's sort of the chronicle of AIDS treatment, AIDS detection, and his way of coping and responding to the symptoms as they presented themselves. So there's a number of things, and I want you to continue to, I guess, as we're covering what's going on currently, how some of these aspects are a reflection of what you were, of your own discovery. We've got now the PrEP, it's the pre-exposure prophylaxis. How does that work, Chris? How effective is it? Is it taken in combination with other medicines? And can you say it's being well accepted and it's being used with the compliant patients?
Sure. PrEP is fairly new to the scene here in the HIV AIDS community, but it's the groundbreaker. We see this as the real game changer here, not just in Orange County, but throughout. And for those who aren't familiar with PrEP, which again is pre-exposure prophylaxis, basically what we've found is that someone who is HIV negative and high risk, if they adhere to the same medication that somebody would take who is HIV positive, that they will be provided with up to a 99% protection rate. So it's not a true vaccine, but in essence, a functional vaccine. And of course, we would want any high-risk individual to not solely use PrEP, but to also combine that with more traditional prevention methods, with condom use, namely, to really give themselves almost a complete protection to the possibility of a new transmission. And so what we're trying to do now is continue to build awareness around this. As of about a year ago, only 1 out of 4 gay men who were surveyed on their awareness of PrEP really had any idea what it was. And that number has grown recently, but we're still building awareness around that so that high-risk individuals do know that this is an option for them to really give themselves an extremely high level of protection.
I guess that's something, Don, you could have, you could imagine the fit for that then. It must be...
I have very differing opinions on PrEP.
Well, this is what we're doing.
Okay. Well, mine as a survivor is quite different than what Chris just said. Okay. To me, I really oppose PrEP in the big picture because this is not focusing on the cure. So a lot of science has gone into this PrEP. Okay. The PrEP will not cover 100%. Okay, until
which
we address
100%,
we don't win the battle. And things get worse over time because we lose the knowledge, we lose the stories. And so it's very important really to focus science now on the cure and not on people, on medicines. The thing is PrEP is effective if you take it as it's prescribed. That's not such an easy thing to do. And so... Even though it's available, you're having it, provided. And statistics have shown, which is good, that it has addressed and improved some of the conditions.
There are public health benefits.
Absolutely. But the thing is that it also gives a false thought that you can have unprotected sex because
right.
you won't get
I've
HIV.
Heard that.
What about the pregnancy? What about chlamydia? What about gonorrhea? What about the sexually transmitted disease that has not been identified yet?
Right,
because
right.
it's
testing
there.
Testing only covers
it's
what
being
we know to
transmitted
test.
Right now, and we haven't yeah. identified it yet.
Yeah,
AIDS was around for 10 years at least in people's bodies. And that's when they started dying. It wasn't so instant. They were actually with the virus like I was for a long period. So that's the reality. So I have a very different view about PrEP. everything with PrEP, I think, should be on the efforts and the money should be on the cure and educating people on safe sex.
Go ahead, Christy. I'm sure you can respond. This is great.
Don's a great friend of mine, but I have to disagree with him a little bit here. I don't think that it has to be one or the other. You know, I feel like that we can continue to search for the cure while implementing this tool that we know we have right now that is proven to lessen the likelihood of new infections. It's not 100%. If not used with more traditional prevention methods, it could possibly open the door for people to, I think, as you said, abuse it. I'm not sure if those are your exact words. But what we know is that it's such an effective tool. And to have this tool and to not make that available to high-risk individuals, we feel would be a real disservice to the community. Because what we do know is that the fact that we're seeing 5 new infections here in Orange County every week, that not everybody is using those traditional methods as is. So if we can add another tool to that toolkit that we know can be highly effective in preventing new infections, we feel that that is a step towards an AIDS-free generation. And of course, we could really achieve that with a cure as well. We just don't know exactly how far away we are from that.
Yeah, and I will say, and scientifically, that there is no generation that you speak of without the cure. We're always seeking global goals right now are to have 90% people that have the virus know they have the virus. And of those people, 90% will be in treatment. And the third 90% goal globally is that 90% in treatment are undetectable so that they have the lowest risk of transmitting the virus. Those are goals of the HIV community global. And what are they? They are 90%. This isn't what we want at all. We need to be seeking for that final cure, eliminate the stigma, eliminate the medicines, everything.
So let's...
And I have faith in the scientific community. Okay. However, money is going into the pills.
Well, and it's interesting. I know that from talking with other guests on this program that the AIDS activism model has been a very potent model that other grassroots organizations have followed to see how to get to advance their own particular agendas. It was an incredible kind of mobilization in terms of using creative, witty, memorable, reflective kinds of testimonials and performances and, you know, ACT UP and all that. I'm sure most listeners that are from the campus here but don't even know what ACT UP was. But all of those kinds of tools in that tool chest were phenomenal in advancing the research for AIDS and the support.
That's correct. And that level of activism is gone. And that's what's needed to address for a cure. That whole activism had to deal with saving lives. It had nothing to do with the cure, necessarily. We were desperate.
Right.
In the beginning, what was hard is that when we knew we were saving lives, but the doctors, that's all they could tell you, they couldn't tell you how long they were saving your life for. They still would say, okay, you're still alive, and then your 2 years that we gave you previously have passed, and so you, as a patient, you would ask your physician, well, how much more time do I have now? And they would say, well, no, let's wait and see. So you just become a guinea pig. But I will say this about the benefit of having the AIDS come into our society, whatever, is that it has helped, like you say, Claudia, about activism. That has helped other causes. But another thing is to keep in mind the science and the speed up of getting medicines and getting the word out to people about the virus. Think of Ebola.
Right.
All of that benefited, and the way we were able to put a lid on that so quickly should have been done by HIV, wasn't, because of the stigma, but it did help in the end Ebola be able to address the things very quickly.
Well, some argue that that was even a slow response, but it could have even been more protracted. So let's.
Yes.
I want to give both of you a chance to tell us what's special about AIDS Services Foundation of Orange County, what it's getting done that merits our attention.
Sure. So we're actually wrapping up this coming AIDS Walk. We'll be wrapping up our 30th year of service to the community. And over these 30 years, we've identified a number of barriers that might prevent someone who's living with HIV from getting the care that they need. And we've developed programs and services to break down these barriers. So ASF has effectively become a health home or a one-stop shop for someone who needs our support. And that allows us to become that safety net. So whether it be access to the food pantry for folks who may otherwise not be able to put food on the table, a transportation department to get people to and from the doctor, mental health counseling, housing, kids and family programs, you name it. It really is, again, that one-stop shop that helps people address whatever it is that's keeping them from care. Because what we do know is that if someone can be in care and stay in care, that they can live a long and healthy life. But for so many people, there's one or more things that are preventing that. And it only takes one or more things to keep someone out of care. And again, that's where ASF comes in and fills that need. And I've seen countless success stories of folks who have come into that agency at the lowest point in their life and have now returned to self-sufficiency. They're working, they're healthy, they have their life back because ASF was there to help plug some of those gaps and get them into the care that they deserve.
And Don is living proof of, and he's a contributor on a regular basis at ASF. And so he can also be a resource in terms of what's maybe going undetected or I don't know if there's some kind of like oversight or if it's a one-on-one kind of volunteering. But what you're saying, that one-stop shopping here, that you're addressing, okay, folks, the stigma is your worst enemy. Let's address what you need. Let's direct you to the resources. So,
If I can give an example of some of the challenges of the continuance of care, the care continuum is critical. That's the absolute reason for my survival is that over the years, I understood how the virus replicated. I understood how the medicines were attacking the virus. And I understood the importance of taking the medicine as prescribed and never missing a dose, ever. And this is really critical and so hard to do. The reality, and one of the things that ASF provides for people is that they...
it's like a playbook.
Well, exactly. And they allow the patients to be able to afford the medications, which are extremely expensive. And there are government programs in the United States, we're so blessed here, that will pay for, it doesn't matter your income, a little bit, but for all practical purposes, medicines are available for everybody and an affordable way, and ASF provides that. The hard part about continuing that care is that you need to sign up every 6 months. You need to be in the
with
right
whom?
State of mind with the county.
Okay.
So you need to go in and sign and say, you know, you're still alive, you still need this assistance. And so all of that is, if you have somebody at ASF to help remind you, just those little things, and say, don't forget, you need to go, it's your 6 months now. That's just one example of the things. You have things like therapy, support groups are critical. ASF provides those. For me personally, what I found, which I would have never thought, and I'll be honest, and I don't know, I think I told Chris this before, when my world fell apart and I was able to recover myself and from the Alzheimer's ward in out of state, when I returned to California, my doc, and I realized the importance of managing this disease, my doctor said, well, there's this organization, ASF.
Okay, so the physicians were
so I had found, this was 1996. I had found out that in my delirium stage, they had gone to ASF. I didn't know that because I was not of a good state of mind. But everybody tried to find me a home, even in Orange County. And at that time, all the hospital beds were taken, and they wouldn't take anybody. So that's why I ended out. So anyway, when I returned and my doctor sent me to ASF, I joined a support group because I wanted to share my experience of that 4 months of hell with the expectation that that's what everybody else was going through. Well, that's not what everybody else was going through. The support groups that I went to, everybody was challenged with physical ailments, and they were all really preparing to die. And I had so much life in me that this just was not a good fit. Well, many years later, when I decided that I was suffering neurocognitive decline and I started volunteering, I also needed to transition from working to not working anymore and making sure I have income and I'm financially stable to do that. Otherwise, I probably would have kept working. And so ASF was able to provide me assistance. They have a benefits resource, a gentleman, Rob Natsahura, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, who's a wonderful man, but helped me with that whole process. And I'm somebody who didn't need pantry needs. I didn't need transportation. I'm somebody that the medical field refers to as a fully functioning or a highly functioning patient of HIV.
And an outlying survivor.
Yes.
We have to say. So for those of you who've joined us, you're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. This is Ask a Leader, and my guests are Chris Bragg and Don Hart. We are talking in advance of the 30th now anniversary AIDS Walk that will be held at Mason Regional Park, right down the road from where we're speaking at this UCI station. And they're posting us on the bigger public health picture on AIDS and HIV. So we're talking specifically about what makes AIDS Services Foundation of Orange County so unique. And I'd like to know from Chris, what are some of the other organizations with whom you're coalescing to sort of leverage more organizational resources?
Sure. Yeah,
coverage.
We're so fortunate to have so many wonderful community partners. You know, just our corporate partners alone are in the dozens. But if you look at who we're really working closely with, first and foremost would be the Orange County Healthcare Agency. We really work closely with them to assess the situation here in Orange County and to strategize with them to making sure that we're meeting all of our clients' needs and the community's needs. We work closely with the California State Office of AIDS. They fund a lot of our prevention work, and we're currently looking into some additional housing funding opportunities. And then when you look on a more grassroots level, there's Shawnee Orange County, which is another AIDS service organization here in Orange County, albeit a bit smaller than ASF. Their focus is more around the South County area and largely around mental health, but we collaborate with them to make sure that a client of ours or a client of theirs, if we need to send them one way to make sure that their service needs are met, we do that.
And that mental health part is, I think, not recognized more broadly. Don is making a very good case for that contribution. So,
right.
And it's or just Shawnee.
Shawnee, Orange County.
Okay, I got that. All right. Yes,
yeah.
Don?
Yeah, I've still got a lot to say about the mental health aspect of the disease. So
you can say a little bit more about that, Don.
Yeah, the mental health. I mean, people don't, and I was able to, you know, I'm fortunate that I was able to study the science and maintain my physical health. I had no idea that I was being affected with mental disorders that were building up. As an example, the 4 months that I had in lockup, and I had periods where I was in a straitjacket and all these things in a very quick 4 month period and fighting in court. And it did a number on me, of course, but I didn't see it at the time. I just was so glad to be alive and return to my life. But what happened was that was a trauma that I pushed aside in my brain. Eventually, I was experiencing post-traumatic stress. That was quite serious. Another thing that...
And it was partly a guilt...
I'm getting to that one.
Okay.
Yeah, mental disorders have several different types of disorders. One is, I mentioned, post-traumatic stress. Another one, as Claudia mentions, is survivor guilt. I got to the point where I really questioned, why is it that I'm here? And that was very troubling to me. And then when I started thinking more and I started getting better again with my mental health, then I started getting what I want to call thriver guilt. Because now when I meet other people who actually have been with the virus as long as me, they're not doing as well. They're not doing as well physically. They're not doing as well mentally. I just have not encountered those things. And the mental problem is there. So now we've got survivor guilt, thriver guilt. Another thing is a mental disorder is exhaustion. Okay, the reality of taking multiple doses of medication multiple times per day, every single day for 20 years, diligently, it's an exhausting process. You have to order your medicines. You have to make sure you get very impatient and you freak out. Where's my medicine? Is it going to be here on time? So this is an exhausting thing on the brain. This is not to mention, so all of these things lead to depression, okay, and isolation. And those are the two critical disorders that most HIV people find themselves in. This is where ASF is a big contributor for the health, is being there, providing the support groups, having people you can come and talk to, and feel safe in that environment. Because I can tell you, the world is not a safe place with HIV. And it's best that people don't know your status, because
still,
because you're going to, if you are somebody who has the virus, you're going to be limiting yourself.
Okay, so let's. Chris was talking a bit about that. There was a mental health component where you're coalescing with the South County Shanti, and there's some other organizations, and I want us to transition quickly after that into what is going to be the who, what, where, how people can sign up for the AIDS Walk. Mm-hmm. So other organizations you want
to just one other one that comes to mind would be the Center Orange County. That's the Gay Lesbian Center that's located in Santa Ana. And we work with them. We collaborate on a lot of our prevention efforts. But also they have very specific programming for our transgendered clients.
Okay.
Folks that we serve who access all of our services. But they have very specific programming for those folks. And so we work closely with them on that.
Okay. And so now, let's fast forward. It's May 14th, but before it's May 14th, there's people signing up to for pledges and things like that. Where do they need to go to get the information to be on, make the deadlines?
Sure. You can find us on Facebook for AIDS Walk Orange County, but also our website is AIDSWalkOrangeCounty.org, and that site is up and running and live. We have people forming their teams now. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, this is our 30th anniversary. And so we're really going to go above and beyond to make this a very memorable walk. We were thinking about, you know, what can we do to kind of commemorate these 30 years? And we thought back to the first walk in 1986 and just what a time that was, specifically in the world of HIV/AIDS. And so our theme this year is reclaiming the 80s. And we're doing an 80s themed walk. And the goal is to take back a decade that's so full of stigma and fear and loss and infuse it with hope and happiness for an eventual AIDS-free generation. And remember the folks that we've lost along the way, but also, again, remind the folks that are still here living with the disease that there's a lot of people out there that love you, that support you. You know, World AIDS Day is on December 1st, but I always consider AIDS Walk Orange County, that's our day here locally to, again, get back out there into the public eye and say, look, we're still here. This is still very much an issue that we're working towards addressing. And there's a lot of folks who are living with disease, and we want you to come out and support them and support us, all while raising critically needed funds to support these programs that are helping folks survive and thrive with HIV.
I'm wondering, was it AIDS that had the first walk of all of the various diseases and syndromes, I'm thinking?
It is the longest running benefit walk here in Orange County, yes.
And then there's every conceivable walk after.
Ours is the most fun.
Well,
but that's another good thing that came from it.
Yes.
You have to, one of the things that have assisted my survival over the years is that I look at the positive side of everything. I just never focus on anything negative. And so that's, you're seeing some good takeaways from a terrible thing.
Well, when I was preparing this script, I thought, well, you know, that I'm imagining Don walking along. This is the 30th commemorative walk. What if you were able to eavesdrop on some conversations on the walk? What would you want to hear people talking about or asking? What would be like the ideal eavesdropping scene?
Asking. That you hit it with one word, asking. Because what we're doing right now, okay, what are we doing? We're disseminating information. It's a one-way process. So I don't know if anybody is, anything that I say is resonating. It does come out of a dialogue, though. Mm-hmm. So that's what I want to hear, is just if I hear people talking about it, that's a good thing. I want them to talk about it, people with all different generations, okay? The thing is, and what I see in people is that people, and I understand why they don't ask questions to people, because they don't want to cause discomfort. They don't know the right questions. And there are few people, I think, like me, who are willing to present themselves as an open book to be able to provide all possible information. And so there just aren't, and I want people to know that they should seek out those people and ask questions, and that's the way you're going to be able to learn and then share with others. Because I see information, I try to educate people, and I know that it doesn't stick.
Well, it takes a couple of rounds for it, for everything, for that traction. But Don, are you going to be wearing a special vest that says something that distinguishes you?
Well, I didn't. And you know, that's very interesting. And this is, you know,
a big
shout out for psychotherapy. Okay, because when I was decided I had a neurocognitive decline, I was a real mess. Okay, I was not comfortable sharing my status with anybody. Okay, and it took 2 years, and after 2 years, and I found out that the AIDS Walk had this program where you could wear a shirt that wrote down the number of years you were surviving.
Okay.
And I had gone to one year, and I saw these things, and I thought, well, these people are going to have a heart attack when they see 34 or whatever, how many years.
Well,
and there's no way I'm going to go walking in a park, and what if my peers? No, I would not reveal my status that way. And it took just one more year of psychotherapy, and I said, I'm going to wear that thing. And then now I'm going to go speak.
Well,
about
you know,
this, and now I'm going to go on a radio program. So,
right-o. As
much this is a growth, and I'm still being cured of things that are disease caused. All my mental disorders were caused by having AIDS, but mainly because of the stigma. And this is why the cure is really the only answer.
Well, Don, one other number I think you ought to emblazon on your vest is how many times you've been in and out of the closet. Too.
That's a really, really good thing that you recognize.
I don't think there's a brochure out there about, oh, you got to go back in the closet now, and you never know why or when or what.
And I just had a foot stepped out of it. I mean, I was just getting, I wasn't totally out of the closet. And so, yeah, very hard. And that's the story.
I know we're running down on the time. Chris has turned everybody over to the AIDS Walk, orangecounty.org, and the Facebook page for the walk for people to sign up and for people to learn. I don't know how we're going to find Don out there, but he'll make himself known around. And so how big is the walk loop there? Because I can envision Mason Park's got two different sections, but it's like the whole sort of manicured part. You just have people keep circling around there?
No, it's a 5K, and we actually have a run for those who are interested in running and having their official time. So there's a 5K walk and run. There's a festival before and after, food vendors,
live
music. The walk steps off at 10 a.m., but you come a little bit before and see some of the opening ceremonies, all of that. And it wraps up around the early afternoon. But again, we're going to really have fun with the theme this year, listen to 80s music, dress in 80s clothing. It's always a good reason to come get dressed up and have a little fun with the day.
Wow. And I know Don has a whole different take on what that 80s felt like, but you've got to sort of take all this texture in, the good with the bad.
No, and it's really challenging for me to see people that weren't around in the 80s trying to recapture the 80s, but I celebrate that.
Okay.
But I actually did live it, so I'm free to field questions about the 80s, too.
All right.
But
well, I want to thank both of you, Chris Bragg and Don Hart. Chris Bragg, the development director at the AIDS Service Foundation in Orange County, and Don, 30-year survivor and a major contributor. Thanks for both of you coming all the way in studio and sharing with us.
Yeah, that would be 34 and a half
34
years.
34 and a half. The number has gone up. I honor all that you've toiled through and may have still in store. Thanks for both of you for coming in today.
Thank you for having us.
We are going to now wrap up the show. Next week, I'll have the dynamic duo, Kathy Esfahani, Costa Mesa Coalition for Affordable Housing, and Linda Tang of the Kennedy Commission, advancing affordable housing in Costa Mesa before the door slams shut with the City Council's efforts to convert existing affordable units into deluxe housing. Talk with you next week. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
Hallelujah, hallelujah. Hallelujah, hallelujah.